good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp.
You're listening to the 602nd episode of Unwelcome Guests, The Ancient Languages of the Future, Part 1. I'm Robin Upton. As the show's title would suggest, we do have a successor program next week. Most of our show this week will be taken up by Marshall Rosenberg, an American psychologist and negotiator, describing a method he's come up with to facilitate communication, and he calls it nonviolent communication. Now, I like his approach, and I've had this recording for some time, but I was lacking anything to go with it. I wanted, as usual, to give contrasting perspectives. And then I found the following recording of Professor Daniel Everett speaking at the London School of Economics in March this year. Professor Everett featured in Ascent of Humanity for his pioneering work with the Piraha, a tribe who live an isolated existence in the middle of the Amazonian rainforest, and whose language lacks counting and other such features that, from a modern Western perspective, seem irreplaceable. They, of course, correspondingly rich in other aspects. We shall hear some of that in just a moment. I thought I'd reflect on Suelo, and the fact that in commercially controlled media, television and BBC love to portray him as a caveman. I didn't have time in the show to reflect on why that is, but are they perhaps wanting to suggest that anybody who gives up money should necessarily give up everything which is bought and sold, which is pretty much all modern technology these days? Now, we know in practice this isn't true. He's got a website. He is very involved in the community. He's certainly not a caveman. I think that's a picture that is being consciously portrayed when media does talk about such people. Now, in the same way, it's quite possible to admit that the Piraha, with their primitive understanding of the world from a Western perspective, are nevertheless very advanced in certain other aspects, that we don't have to go back to living in the middle of a rainforest to see that they have something very valuable. And the future, I believe, is not to embrace any one of these solutions, but to synthesize them and to take what we think to be good and valuable from all these different languages. Now, I am thinking about literal languages, but even more, the metaphorical language of commerce, fiat currency, that is essentially a global monoculture, and I think we are starting to see its replacement by decentralized and diverse alternatives, the first of which I would point as Bitcoin. As we shall hear from Professor Everett, the language is not just a means of communication, but it embodies cultural knowledge and shapes our understanding of the world.
Thanks very much for having me. It's an honor to be here. And I want to talk to you this evening a little bit about language, culture, and being human. Very narrow subject, I suppose. And start off with one of my favorite quotes from the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. Instead of notions borrowed from books and immediately changed into philosophical concepts, I was confronted with the lived experience of native societies, by the commitment of the observer. My mind escaped from the claustrophobic steam bath to which it had been confined by the practice of philosophical reflection. My philosopher friends don't like that. Led to the open air, it felt refreshed by the new breath. Like a city dweller released in the mountains, I became intoxicated while my dazzled eyes examined the richness and variety of the scene. I don't think anyone's ever summarized the joy of field research better than that. And it's an important complement, not a replacement for philosophical reflection, but a complement to it. The video section that you saw was from a new documentary coming out in May in the United States on the Smithsonian Channel and shortly thereafter in Australia and various other countries and hopefully the BBC, called The Grammar of Happiness, which is the final chapter also in my new book, Language the Cultural Tool. And this title was given to the Pinaha film by others who saw them and just, even though they had seen many other indigenous cultures around the world, were struck by the level of happiness and joy that they saw among the Pinahas, which is not uncommon among hunter-gatherers. It's not that I'm saying they're the only, anyone's saying they're the only people that are happy or they are the happiest people in the world, although that was the title of my German book, but I didn't give it that title. But we're saying that they're very, they have mastered something fundamental. And what are some of the things we want to master to achieve a certain level of happiness? Perhaps control over worry. Well, the Pinaha don't talk about the distant past, and they don't talk about the distant future. So by not talking about the distant future, a great deal of discussion that leads to worry and reinforcement through discussion is missing. Since they don't talk much about the distant past, in fact, they don't talk at all about the distant past, it's difficult to have a concept of regret that works very well, because regret involves dwelling on the past. And they also have a fascinating concept of name changing, so that every time a Pinaha has a major experience in their life, their name changes, and they become someone else. And they don't forget that they used to be this person, but they're not to blame for things that person did. And that's a great way to overcome regret. Security. Hunters and gatherers around the world, as long as their environment hasn't changed dramatically, they're deeply secure in what they can do. They can feed themselves fairly easily. How long does it take for a hunter-gatherer to provide food for their family? About 15 to 20 hours a week of work. Women and men have to work 15 to 20 hours a week. What do they do with the rest of their time? Anything they want. This contributes to happiness. They are not perfect people by any means. Nobody is, but they're wonderful, happy people, and it's been my privilege to live with them for nearly 8 years in the jungle over the last 30 years. And you might ask, is there any way to calibrate happiness, to measure degrees of happiness? I asked this to the psychologist who was with me at the time, who had said they were such a happy people. He said, well, I'd probably measure the time they spend smiling and laughing and compare that to the time other societies spend smiling and laughing. So the film, The Grammar of Happiness, has won the Jury of Young Europeans Prize at the International Festival of Audiovisual Programs, FIPA, in France this past January. And that was a very nice prize to win, because it meant that young Europeans sponsored by the French government came from all over Europe to vote on their favorite film of the festival. And it's because of the Pinaha. It's a fabulous film about the Pinaha. So the mind. We know that human beings are somehow unique. We don't find other featherless bipeds walking around, talking to one another, sitting in lectures, talking about their grandparents, and doing all these sorts of things that humans do as a matter of course. So nobody would ever dispute that humans are distinct. Is that a distinction in kind? In other words, do we find traits in humans that we don't find in any other species? Or is it a difference of degree, so that we find humans doing things more intently or better than other species do? That's part of the discussion that we're after. So all humans are capable of counting. The Pinaha are capable of counting. Pinaha children learn how to count when they're exposed to this in Portuguese. Pinaha children raised outside the village grow up speaking fluent Portuguese and counting just fine. But Pinaha in the language has no numbers and no concept of counting, and this has been corroborated by a variety of studies. But what does that mean? It means that counting is not part of the universal human experience. And part of the story that we want to talk about tonight is, what is that human experience? What is it that makes humans unusual from others? Is it a set of genetic programs that we have that others don't have? Or is it our great fluidity and flexibility? And that takes us down to the nature of human languages. What makes language what it is? Is it our grammar? Our syntax? Is it our storytelling? Here's an interesting fact. If I go to do field research on a tribe or group that I've never worked with before, I will not walk in and say, who does the best noun phrases around here? It doesn't make much sense. Because for one thing, not only will they not know what noun phrases are, because that's a peculiar fact of our culture, but they all do them probably this, at the same level of ability. But I will ask, who tells the best stories around here? And every culture I've ever worked with has a concept of a good storyteller and the ability to tell stories well, and that's the person I like to work with whenever possible. Storytelling is very important. So, cognition without numbers. Peter Gordon was the first one to confirm this after I made the claim. He's a psychologist at Columbia University. Then later in 2008, it was corroborated by Michael Frank from Stanford, Evelina Fedorenko, and Ted Gibson from MIT in a paper with me. And recently, I received a new article in the Journal of Cognitive Science in the mail from Caleb Everett, who just happens to be my son, and who's a professor of anthropology at the University of Miami. He says, oh, by the way, I wrote this article and I thought I'd send it to you. I didn't know he was writing it at all, and he wrote it with his mother. So they have also confirmed this, which people may think his mother would be predisposed to confirm what I said, but in fact, not so. So language, its nature, origin, and use. There are two principal alternatives to the nature of human language and where it comes from. One, which is very well known, that goes all the way back to Plato, is called universal grammar, and that is the theory that has been proposed by Noam Chomsky, popularized by Steve Pinker, and many others. The other is less pithy. It is that language is a complex interplay of biology, culture, information science, and yet there's nothing in humans that's specific to language. There are just things that are specific to humans that make us different. So what are some of the things that we can say about universal grammar? What do we know about humans that's specifically genetic to humans dedicated to language? The answer is nothing. We've never found any such thing. So you could say, well, of course there must be universal grammar because rocks can't learn to speak, kittens can't learn to speak, plants don't learn to speak, chimps don't learn to speak. But they do learn a certain amount. If there's nothing specific to human language that we know of, then the claim that there must be something genetic that underlies human language becomes a tautology. Only humans have language because only humans have language. That may not be the case. We'll investigate that. We'll talk about it. And you'll all agree. Maybe. Not. The other approach is the non-universal grammar approach, which is based on a number of other factors, general properties of the mind. But before we get into this discussion and trying to understand, because again, we're trying to understand what makes us human, and language is certainly, my dog is very, very intelligent. I have a Rhodesian Ridgeback, and he taps me with his paw when he wants me to move over on the couch. He points with his nose when he wants me to give him a treat. If I say walk before we go for a walk, he's very excited and jumping up and down. If I say walk after we come back, he looks at me like, what are you talking about? He's a pretty intelligent dog, but he's never told me a story about his grandmother. And he's never really communicated to me the contents of his mind other than what I can read from his emotions. Language is a form of mental telepathy. We think that's science fiction, but in fact language is mental telepathy. It's getting the contents of one mind to another mind. That's the only way we have to do it, is through human language in some way. We can communicate some things without language. You know, so if I scream, that communicates something. A dog's bark communicates something else. But language is the only way we can talk about our grandparents. It's the only way we can get into heavy, deep discussions about what's dear to our hearts. It's what makes us human. No animal will ever tell these stories of any kind, as a matter of fact. Forget the grandparents. Along with culture, language is what gives life meaning. So universal grammar, which is the most popular theory around today, has several different components. First, all languages share the same grammar. So French, Arabic, English, Pidgin, all languages have basically the same grammar. In fact, not basically, they have the same grammar, but it's changed by the words that we have. So we fill in the words. There are a few what are called parameters, which just are slight alterations in grammatical properties that we can acquire. But basically, languages have the same grammar. They differ mainly by their vocabulary. Languages, if they are the outgrowth of a genetic program, that means languages are grown. They're not really learned, right? So you just learn the words, but you don't learn the grammar. The grammar just grows. That's what's there. Culture has no significant input into the computational system, which is grammar, or of any language. In fact, people have gone so far as to claim there's a language organ. A little difficult to find, but the people have claimed that there is. So the number of names associated with this, it is the majority view, but it is not the only view. Now, I want to go into a little bit about the Peter Haas, whom I've lived and worked with for so long, because it was through my encounter with them that I began to think about different properties of language, different possibilities, and how language might not be the way that I had expected it to be. The Pidaha don't call themselves the Pidaha. They call themselves Hiaichehe, which means the straight ones, as you saw in the film. And that is as ethnocentric as it sounds. They think that their language is better and prettier, and they think that they live in a better place, and that they're, you know, they don't say that they're superior to us, but, you know, everybody would be a Pidaha if they could. The Pidaha live in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. If you took out all the country boundaries of Brazil and all the surrounding countries, they would be right in the middle. In Brazil, they're in the northwest section of the Amazon. The Amazon has been reduced by 20% in the last 40 years, but it's still bigger than the continental United States. There's a book. And the social instinct. Are there instincts? Do humans have instincts? Of course we do. One of them, the one that I find the most important for the story we want to tell tonight, was first recognized, presumably, by Aristotle. A social instinct is implanted in all men by nature. What does that mean? It means that we need to communicate and have a sense of community to live and survive as a species. Even the Bible recognizes this. And the Lord God said, "It is not good for man to be alone." That sentence was completed in a different way that had to do with the creation of women, but it still got the social aspect down. And so where did this social aspect of humans come about that distinguishes us from so many other species around the world? Well, we know that humans dominated and became capable of controlling fire roughly 1.6 million years ago in modern-day Kenya, Kobe Fora. And what does fire do? If you can control fire, you sit around the fire, right? When it's cold and when you want to keep away wild animals, it starts to develop community. I think that's one of the reasons that the Greek gods were so afraid of humans dominating fire, because we would challenge them. It's the sense of community. It's exactly the same reasons that led the Hebrew God to say he didn't want all humans speaking the same language, because that sense of community of all people working together seemed to threaten whatever deities they were, whether they were on Mount Olympus or in the heavens. But the sense of community and the sense of togetherness is unique to human beings. There's no other species that will sit around a fire like this just to sit around a fire like this. You'll go to a Pidaha who's sitting with other Pidaha at the fire, and you say, "What are you doing?" Contrary to expectations, we are just sitting here. That's a Pidaha, a word that means contrary to expectations. They're just sitting there enjoying one another's company. Fire and this kind of community is found in many cultures around the world, from Brazil to other places. And we find it today, the sense of community is amazing. So take a group of human beings, put them around a table like this, and put a bunch of bananas in here in the middle. What's going to happen to those bananas? Well, we'll share them very kindly with one another, and if anybody wants a banana, we'll give them a banana. We might even not take one ourselves because there weren't enough bananas to go around, because we have a sense of community. Now, replace all those humans with chimpanzees and put a bunch of bananas in the middle, and what are you going to get? A bloodbath. Other species just don't work like this. They're not like us in the sense that we can actually be out to cooperate and not compete. We're out to work together. That's something that we really have to understand and do a lot of comparative study. But so far, humans are the ones that show that they are the cooperative species. They work together in ways that no other creature does. But to work together, you've got a problem. You've got to be able to communicate. So what is involved in communication? If language is a tool, what problem does it solve? Communication was outlined by the engineer Claude Shannon in the 1940s, and it's fairly simple to see the chart. The mathematics was complicated, to say the least. So you start off with an information source. Maybe that's my brain. And then you want to give a message. So I want to take what the information that's in my brain, let's say, and I want to put it at the destination, which I hope will be your brain. And I have a message. The way I've chosen to give my message tonight is with consonants and vowels, stress patterns. I could have done it by gestures. Fewer would have understood it, besides the fact that I don't know a sign language. I'd just be making them up anyway. And I could have done it by writing and holding up posters like Bob Dylan and Subterranean Homes, whatever that song was. And then I could have done it with smoke signals, which is hard up here. There are any number of ways to communicate. Speech happens to be the most efficient way we have discovered to communicate. So that's probably going to be the transmitter I use is the human vocal apparatus. That signal has to go across the airwaves. It's got to reach your ears. The ears have to translate that into electricity in some way, electronic impulses to the brain, and then you will understand what I'm saying. Maybe if we share the same culture and I'm speaking the same language and I'm using words that most of us know and I'm not inventing. You know, I mean, I could invent every third word could be a word that only I use. That would not be really good for communication. So we need to be sure that we use the words that each other uses. Otherwise, communication doesn't work. So humans are really good at coming up with tools to solve problems. What is one of the most common tools is the bow and arrow. What does the bow and arrow do? I think it's found in just about every culture. It solves the problem of killing protein that moves faster than we do. Okay, so we need to eat protein. You run after it, you're just going to get tired. You'll exert more calories than you will recover. Get a bow and arrow, shoot it, you can eat it, very few calories expended, and therefore you profit from that. We don't need a gene to explain that. There's no bow and arrow gene, at least none that I know of. That just is a common solution to a common problem. And humans are very good at that. So what would it take to create a language tool if we wanted to do that? Well, we'd have to have several things, and it turns out we do have those things. Intentionality, theory of mind, figure versus ground, contingency, background knowledge, consciousness, cultures, and signs. What is intentionality? Intentionality is the ability to focus our attention on something. To all of us, I can say, look there, and all of us can look there. We can focus our attention on something. We're not the only creatures that can do that, but it turns out that we're the only creatures that do point to draw attention to others. Actually, my dog can do that a little bit. I mean, so like if somebody sits in his seat on the couch, he will come up and paw me and look over there. And I ask them to leave, and he gets up there. And so that is actually pointing. So animals are capable of it to a very limited degree, but most animals can't do that. But it's important. It was first studied by Jeremy Bentham, who was one of the founders of University College London. Then we need a theory of mind. This is probably the greatest discovery. It's the thing that distinguishes humans, among other things, from all other creatures. I know that you have a mind like mine. You know that I have a mind like yours. And because we know this, we think it's possible to communicate. It underlies communication. What are some of the experiments that would show that children have a theory of mind? After about 3 years of age, chimps and children, up to 3 years of age, chimps and children perform relatively well. Comparatively speaking, on language tasks. It's at the age of a few months, and then especially at three, that the children kick in with a theory of mind that the chimps never show any evidence for. So do a little experiment like this with a small child. This is Sally. This is Anne. Sally has a ball. She puts it into her basket. Sally goes out for a walk. Anne takes the ball out of the basket and then puts the ball in the box. Now Sally comes back. She wants to play with the ball. Where will Sally look for the ball? Children don't say she will look in the box. Why don't they say she'll look in the box? Because they know Sally has a brain and that Sally has beliefs, and so they'll say Sally will look in the basket because that's where she thinks it is. And that's not something any other creature can do, is to think that some other creature of the same species has a mind alike. Another thing we have to be able to do is distinguish figure versus ground, the focused element from the stuff that's not so important. We do this in vision, we do it in speech, and when it's difficult to do that, we get optical illusions, oral illusions, that sort of thing. So is this a goblet or is it two funny shaped heads looking at each other? And this turns out to be difficult initially for a lot of people to see because they've got to be able to pick out the figure. So if the figure is the goblet, you see the black is just background. If the figure is the black, then the goblet is just background. And that's very important to having language. It's also important to survival, so other creatures can clearly do that. If I'm walking with the Pitahaya in the jungle, I have the ability to see this monkey distinguished from the forest. The forest is the background, the monkey is the figure. But it takes a while to figure that out. So many times when I'm walking with the Pitahaya, I'll feel someone pull me from behind. What's the matter? You're about to step on that alligator. And I literally have been walking in the jungle at night with an alligator right there by the path, and I was going to step on it. Didn't see it. You would think you'd see that pretty well. But it was at night. So how do you see an alligator at night? Two red glows. Here's a really good story from another tribe I work with, the Banawa. We went down to the river at night, and we saw two red eyes swimming towards us. So we knew that was an alligator, a small alligator, actually a small caiman. And then we saw two yellow eyes swimming after the alligator. What was that? It was an anaconda. The alligator is its favorite food, so it was going to eat it. But you got to be able to recognize the stories of colors and eyes and all of this stuff. I remember them pulling me aside and saying, "That's a snake." Where? Right there under the leaves. Where? I don't see it. Right there. I don't see it. Pulled it up. There it is. Okay, now I see it. Contingency is something else that's fundamental to language, knowing what's going to come next. We've got to be able to anticipate something about what our interlocutor is likely to say to us. We have to know who, what, when, where these things are coming. So let me give you a couple of examples that were made famous by Chomsky many years ago. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. This is an old and famous example. When it was first uttered, it was said that this was formed by a grammar with no meaning. But it's been around so long now, and there have been so many poems and stories written about this sentence that for a lot of people, it's perfectly meaningful. Which is it. Don't forget that fact. That turns out to be important. Furiously colorless sleep ideas green is bad all around. It doesn't have a good form, and it has no meaning we can associate with it. Why is that? Well, one possible explanation is that furiously colorless, etc., doesn't follow from the grammar. But the other possibility is that these violate our contingency judgments. In fact, computer scientists have shown that the first sentence, even though it doesn't mean anything, is 200,000 times more likely to occur than the second sentence. There's a great deal more statistical support for the first sentence because it seems more like the kinds of things we say. There's also the fact, very simple fact, that words that have shared meaning tend to occur closer together in sentences. So colorless and green, colorless is an adjective, green is an adjective. You don't expect to find green on the other side of the sentence where there's nothing for it to modify. So these, a number of contingency facts. We also need to know background. So what is the background? It's something about culture that we all know as members of a culture, members of a species. It's something that, so if people tell stories, so talk about a stop sign. It's just a red octagon with the stop in the middle. Now let's say I see a stop sign 1,000 feet in the distance. Should I stop immediately? No. Maybe I go another 250 feet and stop? No, there's an infinite number of stopping points possible, but part of the background knowledge is I stop right before I get to it, just in front of it. And then I look both ways, and then I go across. That cultural information doesn't have to be listed on the stop sign. It would make really small letters anyway. You could have a series of pre-stop signs, not yet, not yet, not yet, now. But we don't need to do that because that's shared knowledge that we all have. So several years ago, computer scientists at Yale University wanted to show that computers could master human reasoning. So they designed a series of scripts. This was led by Roger Schenck and his colleagues. And they had a script, for example, a man walks into a restaurant. They tell the computer this. He orders a hamburger. The hamburger comes. It's burnt. The man is angry. He gets up, and he storms out of the restaurant. Now ask the computer, did he pay for the hamburger? And the computer says, why, no. So the computer reasons like a person, correct? Actually not. John Searle, the philosopher from University of California, Berkeley, said, can I ask the computer a few questions? Sure. Did the man put the hamburger in his ear? I don't know. Did he wear it as a hat? I don't know. Did he wrap it in cellophane and play tennis with it? I don't know. The computer doesn't know all of this because it hasn't been programmed in. It hasn't been made explicit. Searle's point was that you can never program all this knowledge in. Humans acquire this knowledge as members of cultures and societies, and they make a number of associations so that not all of it is taught explicitly, but it's too complicated to program in, and it's part of language. When we tell stories, Part of what we leave out is what we all know to be the same. That's why I call it to be the dark cognitive matter of stories or discourse. We also need consciousness. We don't know really that well yet what causes consciousness. Some people say consciousness isn't possible without language. But in fact, consciousness does occur without language. We know that animals can be conscious. At least I think animals can be conscious. I also think that when I listen to stories of Helen Keller, the famous deaf-mute blind person from the United States, who talks about her consciousness prior to acquiring language, that's a pretty good refutation of the idea that you need language for consciousness. In fact, I think you need consciousness for language. If you're unconscious, it's hard to talk. You need culture, and this is where we have to spend a little time. What is culture? We know when we see different cultures that they're not the same as ours. So culture has two main forces, and I will talk about something else that I think is at least as important as these two main forces: imitation and innovation. Imitation, why do we have these two forces? Let's say that there's a group of people moving together and there are problems in the environment, but they don't vary that frequently. Say, you know, the problems remain more or less constant if you stay in the same environment. So is it more efficient for you to learn how to solve all those problems on your own or to imitate other people who are imitating other people who already know how to solve those problems? Most of the time, it's easier just to imitate. And that's what most of us do all the time. In language and in the way we live and the way we dress, we just imitate other people. A little bit of innovation here and there, but if we innovate too much, we'll be seen as weird or eccentric, however you want to put it. But if the environment changes and now the cultural solutions that we've proposed that our ancestors have given us don't work, we'll either all die or someone has to innovate something that is a solution that we can go back to imitating. So it seems that human cognitive development took off in a major way during the Pleistocene era when the climate was changing so radically and problems had to be solved. Humans responded to that very well. So imitation is a great solution for a lot of problems as long as the environment stays the same. But sometimes we need to innovate.
And that interesting point in the discourse, not the end of the lecture, but that's the end for this week. I think by pretty much any measure, we are in a period of fast change, and so that's a positive note to reflect on, that innovators are very much wanted and needed. And if ever we had a technology to facilitate imitation and quick uptake of new ideas, then the World Wide Web and YouTube give us that facility. Now, I'm going to say a special thanks to Clive from the UK for pointing me to bottle lights. If you want to know what bottle lights are, how a light could run without electricity, then there's a link to them from this show's webpage. That's unwelcomeguest.net/602. I'm going to be creating bottle lights this summer for the poor of Bangladesh, and I would welcome any such low-tech solutions, any such new ways of doing things which you think might suit Bangladesh. Please submit them to me via email, unwelcome@unwelcomeguest.net. Now, let's hear Marshall Rosenberg. This is a recording from a DVD from some years ago.
But first, let me begin by clarifying the purpose of nonviolent communication. Its purpose is to help you to do what you already know how to do. Now, why do we need to learn something today that you already know how to do? Because sometimes we forget to do this. We forget because we've been educated to forget. Now, what is it that I'm talking about that we already know how to do? The purpose of this process is to help us to connect in a way that makes natural giving possible. Natural giving possible. What do I mean by natural giving? Let me do you a song to make it clear what I mean by natural giving. I never feel more given to than when you take from me. When you understand the joy I feel caring for you, And you know my giving isn't done to put you in my debt, but because I want to live the love I feel for you. To receive with grace may be the greatest giving. There's no way that I can separate the two. When you give to me, I give you my receiving. And when you take from me, I feel so given to. You all know that giving. You know how to do it. And that's what I'm interested in. I'm remembering to stay with that quality of giving, moment by moment, in any connection. But we also all know that it's easy to lose it. It's easy to lose that connection, so that instead of enjoying that quality of giving, which is possible every moment in every contact we have, in spite of how precious that is, we forget. And instead of playing the game that that song is about, which I call Making Life Wonderful, it's the most fun game I've ever heard. Instead, much of the time we play another game called Who's Right? Have you ever played that game? It's a game where everybody loses. So isn't this amazing that we all know about this quality of giving that the song was about? It's possible every moment we find that the richest thing to do, and much of our life we end up playing Who's Right. Now, the game of Who's Right involves two of the most devious things human beings have ever come upon. One, punishment. See, because if you're wrong in the game of Who's Right, then you deserve to suffer. Can you imagine a more diabolical concept to educate people? So, if you haven't already abstained from punishment, I'm sure by the end of the day that will no longer be a part of your consciousness. No more punishment. You won't do it in your families. We'll get rid of it with criminals. It just makes things more violent. We'll find other ways to deal with other nations beside punishment. No more punishment. No more reward. It's the same game. It's part of the game of Who's Right. If you're right, then you get rewarded. If you're wrong, you get punished. No more. No more. It's created enough violence on the planet. No more guilt induction. See? No more shame. No more concepts of duty and obligation. Just what the song is about. Natural giving. So how did we get off target? We got off target according to Walter Wink, a theologian who writes in his book, The Powers That Be. We got off target about 5,000 years ago. We got off target because we started to get some wild thinking. Wild thinking that human beings are innately evil. And when you believe that human beings are innately evil, then if things aren't going as we would like, what's the corrective process? The corrective process is penitence, you see. When people are evil, you think that the way to bring about change when people are behaving in a way you don't like is to make people hate themselves for what they're doing. So for these political reasons and theological reasons, we started to develop a language that I call jackal language. It's a language that cuts us off from life and makes it very easy to be violent. Very easy to be violent. In fact, in that book I mentioned, Wink says that domination cultures, one of the things you have to educate people is to make violence enjoyable. See? And we've done a good job of that. We make violence enjoyable in our culture. the 2 hours a night from 7 to 9 when children are watching television the most, and 75% of the programs they watch, the hero either kills somebody or beats them up, you see? And when does this happen? At the climax of the program. We've been educated for quite a while to make violence enjoyable. So even though I think what that song was about is what is really closer to our nature, this natural giving, we've been educated to make violence enjoyable, and educated in a way we can even be violent to our children. So what is jackal language like? See, jackal language, as I've mentioned, is a language of moralistic judgments. Think in terms of who's right, who's wrong, who's good, who's bad. And when you mention change, yes, we want change at times. So how do you get change in the jackal system? Watch a parent try to bring about change in the child. This is a parent teaching a young child, say, one of the most important words in jackal. Say you're sorry. I'm sorry. You're not really sorry. I can see it. You're not really sorry.
I'm sorry.
Okay, I forgive you. Can you imagine a game like that? Can you imagine a parent responding to a child that way? And if a parent is going to do that to a child in their own family, what are they going to do to people from other cultures who behave in a way they don't appreciate? So, of course, you're going to have violence wherever you have this kind of thinking. In cultures that do not have this thinking, you don't see violence, you see. So, that's how we got off target. Even though we could be playing the game, make life wonderful each moment, we have been educated for quite a while to play another game, who's right. So what are the parts of this game of who's right? I've just mentioned one of them. One part is moralistic judgments, learning how to go up to our head and think basically in terms of right and wrong, good and bad, normal, abnormal. I learned this game very well. I speak several dialects of jackal. I grew up in Detroit. We spoke a rather harsh dialect of jackal. You might call it Detroit jackal. For example, if I'm out driving, and someone is driving in a way that I don't like, and again, I want to install change, you see, I roll down the window, "Idiot!" Now, theoretically, the person is supposed to repent. See? I confess I was wrong, sir. I will change the error of my ways. It's a great theory. It didn't work. I've tried it more than once. It doesn't work. So I thought maybe it was that particular dialect of jackal. So I decided to get the more cultured use of jackal. So I went to the university and got a doctor's degree in professional jackal. Now when somebody's driving in a way I don't like, I roll down the window. Psychopath! Still doesn't work. You see. There's another part of this language of jackal. Amtssprache. Amtssprache. That's very important, you see, a language that denies choice, denies responsibility for our actions. I use the word Amtssprache for this part, having read an interview with the Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann at his trial for war crimes in Jerusalem. Eichmann was asked, was it hard to send tens of thousands of people to their death? And Eichmann answered candidly, he said, to tell you the truth, it was easy. Our language made it easy. That interview shocked, that answer shocked his interviewer. And his interviewer said, what language? Eichmann said, in fact, my fellow Nazi officers and I, we had our own name for our language. We called it Amtssprache. Amt in German means office, and Sprache, language. I'd call that bureaucratic language. He was asked for some examples. Eichmann said, it's a language in which you deny responsibility for your actions. So if somebody asks you why you did it, you say, I had to. Then you don't feel so bad if you have to do it, you see. You're not responsible. But why did you have to, Jack? Superior's orders. Company policy. They made me do it. I couldn't do elsewise. Very dangerous language, Amtssprache. Very dangerous. We have giraffe schools. I use the word giraffe, you see, as a symbol for nonviolence. We'll see today that the language we're going to study is the language of the heart. And so I use giraffe language for that because giraffes have the largest heart of any land animal. So, giraffe requires always being conscious of choice, you see. We never do anything that we don't choose to do. But I was teaching giraffe to a group of parents and teachers in one community, and we have giraffe schools throughout the world. We have 5 in Israel, 4 in Palestine, some in Serbia, and so forth. And in giraffe schools, of course, we want to make sure that certainly that the teachers and parents never use Amtssprache. One of the most dangerous languages in the world. To teach a child, you have to do something. So I was saying this one time in St. Louis, Missouri, to a group of parents and teachers, and a mother got very upset. She said, but there are some things you have to do, whether you like to do it or not. It's our job as parents to teach our children what they have to do. I mean, there's things I do every day that I hate to do, but there just are some things you have to do. Well, I said, could you give me an example? She said, well, easy, there's so many, let me think. Okay, like when I leave here tonight, I have to go home and cook. I hate to cook. I hate it with a passion, but I've done it every day for 20 years. Even when I've been sick. Well, I said, I'll be very happy today to show you another way of thinking, another language that I hope would open up happier possibilities for you. Well, I'm pleased to report she was a rapid giraffe student. She went home that very evening and announced to her family that she no longer wanted to cook. I got some feedback from her family. The feedback came 2 weeks later when I swung through that city again and was doing an evening workshop. And who shows up? Her 2 older sons. She had 4 sons. They came up at the beginning to introduce themselves, and I said, hey, I'm glad you guys came up here. I've been very curious what's going on in your family. Your mother's been calling me regularly, telling me about all the changes she made in her life since the training. And what happened that first night when she came home and announced that she no longer wanted to cook? The oldest son said to me, Marshall, I said to myself, thank God. I said, help me understand that one. He said, I said to myself, now maybe she won't complain at every meal, you see. You see, natural giving, what I started the day off with that song, anything we do in life that isn't coming out of that energy, we pay for it and everybody else pays for it. Anything we do out of fear of punishment if we don't, everybody pays for it. Anything we do for a reward, everybody pays for it. Everything we do to make people like us, everybody pays for it. Everything we do out of guilt, shame, duty, obligation, everybody pays for it. That isn't what we were designed for. We were designed to enjoy giving, to give from the heart.
Marshall?
Yes.
I'm over here. My son brought me to one of your seminars, and I met you some 10 years ago.
Yes.
In Oakland.
Yes.
Now I'm trying to bring my son back to come here. And he said last night when I told him I was coming here, he said, well, why don't you go? I have a couple of appointments. Maybe you could teach me something. So I thought I would come to learn something. Maybe I could teach him. But I'd like to teach him, and I don't know how to do that. Well, I'd like to teach him to at least give me the time of day to communicate with him. He doesn't do that. willingly. Okay. And when I try to demand it, it becomes worse.
Yes.
So how do I do that?
Well, that'll be a good situation to work on today, because I'm going to ask everyone to think of a situation right now where somebody's behaving in a way you don't like. So in this case, it's your son who, when you ask him to communicate, he says no. The first thing I'll suggest is you can't teach anybody anything.
That's right.
And to have that as an objective is itself to create problems. So
yeah.
So let's change the objective. Let's never try to teach anybody anything or to change anybody. Hmm. If that's your objective, you'll create resistance.
Hmm.
So that'd be my first suggestion today. Never try to teach anybody anything or to change anybody. That clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what do you do then? Give up?
No. See, this is the thinking that's been shaped in us by Jackal. See, the game of who's right, win, lose. So then if we can't change and win, then the option we think of is to be a chump and lose, you see. We've been educated to think in those two ways, win, lose, right, wrong. No, I'll show you a way, another option. Okay, let's get into it. Let's give you a chance to practice it. Some of you have already thought of situations, such as somebody you want very much to communicate with, they say no. So, think of somebody at the moment who is behaving in a way that is not making life wonderful for you, and you'd like to get to the place that the song was about, where everybody's needs can get met and people are giving to one another from the heart, willingly, not out of coercion, you see. Let's see if we can show you a process to get there in this situation, to get everybody's needs met and where people give willingly, not out of any coercion. So maybe you are living at home. Maybe you choose today to work on a child that you are living with at home who says horrible, horrible jackal things such as, no. Oh, you laugh. You try living with one for a while. Please brush your teeth. No. Maybe you are living at home with a jackal-speaking partner who says horrible jackal things such as, that hurts me when you say that. We'll see today that it's a violent act to say others make you feel as you do. See? To imply that others can make you feel hurt or angry. Maybe at work somebody's behaving in a way you don't like. They come late. They're not producing as well as you would like. Maybe your next door neighbor has been sexually molesting children. Whoever you want to pick, somebody who's behaving in a way you don't like. And you'd like to see how we would arrive at the objective of creating the quality of connection that will get everybody's needs met through natural giving. That's our objective. Okay? Now, open up your materials to expressing how we are and what we would like. And it says under A, think of someone who does something that makes life less than wonderful for you. So this person that I'm asking you to think about, who's presently behaving in a way you're not crazy about, and what I'd like you to do is answer this question. Write here one thing that the person does that you don't like. We're going to work on one specific action that the person does that you don't like to get you familiar with the process today. Maybe the person does several things, but we're going to show you how the process works by showing you how to communicate with the person about one specific thing they do. Now, when I was here in San Francisco working with the school system back in the 70s, the superintendent of schools asked me to go into an elementary school. He said the parents are complaining about the quality of relationship between these teachers and the administrator. They said the tension in the school is so great that the parents want to take their children out of the school. So he asked if I would go in and see if I could open up better communication between the staff and the administrator. The plan was I would meet first with the teachers and then get the teachers and the administrator together. So in my meeting with the teachers, I started with the question that I just asked you. I said to the teachers, can you tell me one thing that the administrator does that makes it hard for you to work with him? I was asking for an observation. a concrete behavior. What is one thing he does? The first teacher to respond said this: he has a big mouth. Now, can you see the difference between the question I ask and the answer I got? I did not ask, what size mouth does the principal have? So this teacher was giving me an evaluation, an analysis that implies wrongness. You see, we've been so trained to think that way that sometimes we can't separate fact and opinion. All we see is our enemy image. Whether it's an individual or a nation, we have been trained to think in enemy images, wrongness. And it obscures reality. We don't see the behavior, we just see our enemy image. In his book, Out of Weakness, Andrew Schmuckler says that when cultures are taught to think this way, not to just see the person, but an image, a judgment they've made, bombs are never far away, you see. So I pointed this out to the gentleman that this was not an answer to my question. I wanted to know one thing the principal did. This man was stuck. He just couldn't get it. The woman sitting next to him tried to help. She says, well, I know what he's referring to. I said, okay, help him out. What's one thing that the principal does? He talks too much. No, too much is a judgment. I ask for an observation, not a judgment. See, this is how jackal-speaking people think. They really have been brought up to think there is such a thing as a just right amount of everything. And too much and too little, and that they know what it is, see? So they think that way. It doesn't make resolving conflicts too easy with them. When people have an idea that there's a right and a too much and a too little, and they know what it is, and especially when they mix it up with an observation. I was just asking, what does the person do? And again, for the second time, this person couldn't see the behavior separate from the judgment. A third person tried to help. Well, I know what they're talking about. Okay, what? He thinks he's the only one that has anything worth saying. No, telling me what you think he thinks is an evaluation you're making of what you think is going on in his head. I was asking for what does he do? A fourth woman said, he wants to be the center of attention all the time. I said, now you're giving me a judgment or a diagnosis of his motives. Even if it's accurate, it's a diagnosis of his motives. It's not an observable behavior. My question was, what does he do? Now the entire faculty sits there quiet. Nobody can answer the question. And one of the women said to me, boy, Marshall, that's hard to do. Yes. In fact, the philosopher Krishnamurti says that to observe without evaluating is the highest form of human intelligence. You see. So those of us who have been taught to think in these enemy images, immediately to think right, wrong, good, bad, normal, abnormal, appropriate, inappropriate, to this, to that, we can't see reality. All we see is our enemy images. Well, with great help, with great effort on my part, I finally got them to get rid of the images and answer this simple question: what does he do? There was several things, but the one that they wanted particularly to start working with him on was this: that during their once-a-week faculty meetings, regardless of what was on the agenda, he would relate it to a war experience or a childhood experience. And the average meeting lasted 20 minutes longer than it was scheduled. Okay, that answered my question of what he did. He talked about war experiences, childhood experiences, rather than sticking to the agenda. I said, have you called that to his attention? They said, well, we can see now that when we try to talk to him about it, these other judgments get mixed in, and he gets defensive.